This hour of Top Stories, people in the U.S. state of Georgia vote in runoff elections that will determine whether Republicans or Democrats control the Senate. Iran issues a red notice request to Interpol seeking the arrest of the U.S. president and 47 others in connection with the assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani last year. And also this hour, Saudi Arabia, along with its three Arab allies, has agreed to restore full ties with Qatar. Our top story this hour, vote counting is underway in a pair of Senate runoff elections in the U.S. state of Georgia. With over half of the votes counted now, Democrats maintain a narrow lead over Republicans. Local officials, however, say it's too early to call the winners. Two incumbent Republican lawmakers and two newcomer Democrats are vying for seats in the U.S. Senate. The election determines which party will have an edge in the Congress's upper chamber and suggest how much President-elect Joe Biden can achieve in the next 2 years. Democrats need to win both races to take control of the Senate from Republicans. The final results are not likely to come out before Wednesday morning. Colin Campbell joined us earlier with a breakdown of why the Senate races are decisive for the U.S. politics.
Right now, if the Republicans win, that would mean that they have a majority in the Senate. If President-elect Joe Biden, or when President-elect Joe Biden becomes president and he wants legislation passed, Republicans can block that legislation. So anything progressive or democratic that the Democrats want to put forward to change the country or just to change the growing wealth disparity, the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, some of the police brutality issues and justice and racism issues, those may not come to the fore if you have Republicans in the Senate that can block a lot of that activity. Now, the flip side is, if the Democrats win, well, then you have a possibility of a 50, you have the 50-50 split, right? Each state gets two senators. And the person who would break that tie would be the vice president, who would be a Democrat. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris would be the vice president. She would break any ties on legislation that just goes straight down partisan lines.
Protesters gather in the U.S. Capitol ahead of the affirmation of President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the November presidential election. Demonstrators supporting President Donald Trump gathered in Washington, D.C. to show frustration at the outcome of the race for the White House. Similar protests are planned by multiple pro-Trump groups for Wednesday when Joe Biden's win is slated to be certified by Congress. The president has announced that he will address the rally of his supporters on Wednesday. Authorities in the U.S. Capitol have boosted security as the event draws close. Washington, D.C. has mobilized the National Guard and issued a warning to protesters against carrying any sort of firearms.
U.S. Congress is set to cement President-elect Joe Biden's election win. There is going to be a formal count of electoral colleges that have already been certified by all the governors. It all seems to be a normal, smooth process. However, a group of Republican senators announced that they will object to certification of the Electoral College. They promised long hours or even days of protests in order to delay the announcement of Congress.
I would imagine that at some point, even the most ardent Trump supporter would realize that it's an exercise in futility to go through with that extremist strategy. But yes, in the extreme, there could be multiple challenges and the process could drag out for hours or even days, but not through January 20th.
This is just another delay tactic. It's a protest by some Republicans, but it's going to fail. At the end of the week, we'll see that Joe Biden is expected to become the American president.
This is the latest in a series of efforts made by Donald Trump and his supporters to overturn the election. Since the announcement of Biden's victory in November's election, Trump has time and again objected to the result and called the vote rigged. However, several federal courts, along with the U.S. Supreme Court, have said that no act of fraud has been found in November's election.
So it is more of a political show of loyalty than an actual attempt to overturn the election results.
Most Republican senators describe the action of their colleagues as a threat to the integrity of the institutions and democracy. This joint session of Congress does not have the power to change the result of November's election. However, these Republicans are planning to move forward with their planned protest and ask for a 10-day audit in the states that are in dispute. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Corvello.
The United States has imposed fresh sanctions against Iran, targeting the country's steel industry this time. The measures target a dozen Iranian steel and metal makers and a Chinese company that makes elements for steel production. Among the blacklisted firms is Iran-based Middle East Mines and Mineral Industries Development Holding Company. The U.S. Treasury Department says it is also designating the company's subsidiaries and sales agents in Germany, China, and the UK. The restrictions are part of the outgoing U.S. President's administration's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Tehran has repeatedly condemned the sanctions, saying they account to or amount that is to economic terrorism. Iran has requested Interpol to issue a red notice for those involved in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Iran's judiciary spokesman Ghulam Hossein Ismaili said Tehran has identified 48 people in connection with the assassination. He said they include U.S. President Donald Trump, Pentagon officials, as well as American forces in the region. Ismaili said Iran, in its request, has made it clear the role each individual played in the killing. He stressed that Iran will seriously pursue the issue to bring the perpetrators to justice. General Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone attack ordered by President Trump last January. The attack took place near Iraq's capital, Baghdad. Political commentator Jim W. Dean believes Iran's decision to take the U.S. to the court over Washington's assassination of late General Soleimani is a right one.
Well, I'm surprised that Iran has been able to collect all the details to come up with 43 names. And I think it also shows that it's not going to take any military action, which now would be a terrible time and self-defeating, but really kind of go into the courts and put their evidence on the table and world opinion, and see what the U.S. can do. We know now from the history that Trump tried to put his stamp of cover on this, that there was an imminent threat to American personnel, which we, I think, is highly doubtable, because the Iraqi parliament was briefed the day afterwards that Soleimani was coming there to Baghdad on a diplomatic mission to discuss an ongoing breakthrough with UAE and the Persian Gulf to de-escalate the situation.
Iran's army has staged a large-scale drill that used hundreds of domestically made drones. The two-day maneuvers are aimed at organizing and enhancing the preparedness of Iran's army in drone combats. Our correspondent Youssef Jalali has filed a report.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's army kicked off a maneuver that put to test hundreds of its domestically built unmanned aerial vehicles. The two-day military exercises saw the use of a variety of surveillance and reconnaissance drones, combat drones, bombers, and loitering munitions, which are known as suicide drones. As part of the drill, the Persian Gulf was simulated as the conflict zone, where the Iranian Army's Navy use the suicide drones to destroy their targets.
All of the four forces of the army took part in the drills by deploying their drones. Each force concentrated on their assigned missions. We at the Navy used a variety of our stealth drones that can fly deep into the enemy's waters and keep a close eye on their activities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's defense industry has been hit by U.S. arms embargoes for four decades. The sanctions have barred Iran from purchasing any foreign weapons, even from its closest allies. However, Iranian officials say the country's defense sector is up and running. The reason is the country has for all these years been developing its own arms based on domestic capabilities. And now drones are the epitome of Iran's advances in the defense industry.
In the field of UAVs, Iran is neck and neck with the few countries that have the technology. We began by producing surveillance UAVs, but today our unmanned aircraft can conduct combat missions as well. And we owe this achievement to US sanctions, because they forced us to rely on our domestic resources.
The Islamic Republic stepped into the field of UAV production around 2011 by reverse engineering American and Israeli drones it electronically commandeered or shot down. Tehran says today it is self-sufficient in designing, producing, and operating a range of UAVs with different applications. In less than a decade, the term UAV grew from an alien word to a keyword in Iran's airspace. Still, the Iranian army says this is just the tip of the iceberg, and the greater part of Iran's defense capabilities is yet to be publicized. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drill.
Welcome back. Saudi Arabia has finally decided to lift a border blockade on Qatar. The move is seen as a major step toward ending a diplomatic rift that saw Riyadh leading an alliance to isolate Doha for 3 years. Here's a report.
Saudi Arabia seems changing its diplomatic course with regard to neighboring Qatar as years-long blockade by Riyadh and some of its allies failed to force Doha to bow to their demands. The Kuwaiti foreign minister announced a diplomatic breakthrough, saying Saudi Arabia has decided to reopen its air, land, and sea borders to Qatar.
Based on a suggestion of Sheikh Nawaf Al Ahmed Al Sabah, Emir of the state, an agreement has been reached for the reopening of land and sea borders between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the state of Qatar starting tonight.
Following the announcement, Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani accepted an invitation to attend a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia. Upon his arrival to the Saudi city of Al Ula, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman gave a warm welcome to Sheikh Tamim. In the summit, the leaders of the six-member Persian Gulf Cooperation Council signed a rapprochement agreement, although the details were not immediately released.
These efforts helped us reach the agreement of the Al-Ula statement that will be signed at this summit, where we affirm our Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability.
During the meeting, however, bin Salman missed no chance to repeat his anti-Iran rhetoric, describing Tehran's missile program as a threat to the region. But what actually had caused the conflict between Doha and Riyadh? In June 2017, Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. They cut ties and transport links with Qatar. Ironically, Saudi Arabia is accused of the same charges it is leveled against Qatar. Doha also repeatedly denied the allegations and said it was targeted because it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for the reconciliation. Qatar has not publicly bowed to any of the demands. Saudi Arabia has constantly pursued the policy of fueling regional tensions. Some of its allegations against Qatar even demonstrated Saudi hypocrisy, as the kingdom has long been engaged in regional conflicts. While its interference in Libya and Bahrain, as well as its anti-Iran rhetoric, is not hidden anymore, the kingdom's full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen has also exposed its hegemonic agenda. Undoubtedly, Riyadh's decision to ease the Qatar blockade proves the failure of its policy of siege and aggression. However, the credit goes to Doha that stood firm against what it called bullying by some Arab states, and so were the Qatari citizens, who seemed galvanized by patriotic feelings.
Israeli forces have shot dead a Palestinian man southwest of the occupied West Bank city of Beit Lehem. The Palestinian Health Ministry has confirmed the shooting death, or the shooting death, but did not give details about the victim. The Israeli military claims the man was hit after he tried to carry out a stabbing attack. The regime's forces regularly open fatal fire on Palestinians, citing similar pretexts. Human rights groups have repeatedly slammed Israel for its shoot-to-kill policy, saying a large number of Palestinians who were killed and had not posed any serious threat to Israeli forces. The United Kingdom reports its highest daily coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic, just a day after the government announced new restrictions to curb the surge in infections. Britain reported nearly 61,000 new cases of the virus, taking the total to more than 2.7 million. The virus has also claimed over 76,000 lives in the UK. The latest figures come less than 24 hours after British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced a new national lockdown to contain the more contagious variant of the coronavirus. Johnson said the surge in cases threatens to overwhelm parts of the health system before a vaccine program reaches a critical mass. Meanwhile, Germany is extending its nationwide lockdown until the end of the month and introducing tougher new restrictions.
We want to extend the decisions we took in December until January the 31st. And we will also have to tighten up the restrictions in some areas for the reasons I have just mentioned. We ask all citizens to restrict contacts to the absolute minimum necessary.
The new rules restrict, for the first time, non-essential travel for residents of hard-hit areas all over Germany. Merkel added that the state leaders would review the new measures on January the 25th. The new measures come as Germany, like many other European countries, is struggling to contain a second wave of the virus. So far, over 1.7 million people have tested positive for COVID-19 in the country, while more than 35,000 have lost their lives. Saipur Reza joined us earlier to give us an update on the situation of the COVID-19 pandemic within the UK.
The numbers are really high, and today's briefing by the Prime Minister and the top scientists that advise him didn't bode well for how things are going to look like in the coming weeks and months. This briefing that happened at number 10 Downing Street, after a U-turn, the bombshell news yesterday by the government putting the country on lockdown. It seems to be this government's modus operandi. Usually they say something and then within days or weeks they backpedal and do a totally different thing. According to the ONS, the Office for National Statistics, 1 in 50 people in England now has COVID. That's like 1.1 million people in a population of nearly 60 million, and 1.3 million in a population of more than 68 million countrywide. A warning also by the top scientists that the virus, especially the new variant, has really taken off, perhaps suggesting that it's really out of control, that really merited that decision to put the country on lockdown. Nearly 61,000 people, as you just said, have tested positive over the past 24 hours. And this is the first time that the number has exceeded the 60,000 mark since the pandemic began.
And that's it with international news.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
More than 2,900 U.S. healthcare workers have died in the COVID-19 pandemic since March, a far higher number than that reported by the U.S. government, according to a new analysis by KHN and The Guardian. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written jointly by Christina Jouet, Robert Lewis and Melissa Bailey writers. This article is published under the heading, U.S. barely kept track of nearly 3,000 healthcare workers that died in 2020. Here's the details of this article. More than 2,900 U.S. healthcare workers have died in the COVID-19 pandemic since March, a far higher number than that reported by the government, according to a new analysis by KHN and The Guardian. Fatalities from the coronavirus have skewed young, with the majority of victims under the age of 60 in cases for which there is age data. People of color have been disproportionately affected, accounting for about 65% of deaths in cases in which there is race and ethnicity data. After conducting interviews with relatives and friends of around 300 victims, KHN and The Guardian learned that one-third of the fatalities involved concerns over inadequate personal protective equipment. Many of the deaths, about 680, occurred in New York and New Jersey, which were hit hard early in the pandemic. Significant numbers also died in southern and western states in ensuing months. The findings are part of Lost on the Frontline, a 9-month data and investigative project by KHN and The Guardian to track every healthcare worker who dies of COVID-19. One of those lost, Vincent D. Jesus, 39, told his brother Neil that he'd be in deep trouble if he spent much time with a COVID-positive patient while wearing the surgical mask provided to him by the Las Vegas hospital where he worked. DeJesus died on August 15th. Another fatality was Sue Williams Ward, a 60-year-old home health aide who earned $13 an hour in Indianapolis and bathed, dressed, and fed clients without wearing any PPE. Her husband said she was intubated for 6 weeks before she died on May 2nd. Loss on the front line is prompting new government action to explore the root cause of healthcare worker deaths and take steps to track them better. Officials at the Department of Health and Human Services recently asked the National Academy of Sciences for a rapid expert consultation on why so many healthcare workers are dying in the U.S., citing the count of fallen workers by Guardian and KHN. The question is, where are they becoming infected? Asked Michael Osterholm, a member of Joe Biden COVID-19 advisory team and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. That is clearly a critical issue we need to answer, and we don't have that, he added. The December 10th report by the National Academies suggests a new federal tracking system and specially trained contact tracers who would take PPE policies and availability into consideration. Doing so would add critical knowledge that could inform generations to come and give meaning to the lives lost. Those healthcare workers are people who walked into places of work every day because they cared about patients, putting food on the table for families, and every single one of those lives matter, said Suan Bell, a University of Michigan assistant professor of nursing and co-author of the National Academies report. The recommendations come at a fraught moment for healthcare workers, as some are getting the COVID-19 vaccine while others are fighting for their lives amid the highest levels of infection the nation has seen. The toll continues to mount. In Indianapolis, for example, 41-year-old nurse practitioner Kendra Irons died on December 1st. She saw 7 or 8 home health patients per week while wearing full PPE, including an N95 mask and a face shield, according to her husband, Marcus Irons. The virus destroyed her lungs so badly that 6 weeks on the most aggressive life support equipment, ECMO, couldn't save her, he said. Marcus Irons said he is now struggling financially to support their 2 youngest children, ages 12 and 15. Nobody should have to go through what we are going through, he said. In Massachusetts, 43-year-old Mike Flynn oversaw transportation and laundry services at North Shore Medical Center, a hospital in Salem, Massachusetts. He and his wife were also raising young children ages 8, 10, and 11. Flynn fell ill in late November and died on December 8. He had a heart attack at home on the couch, according to his father, Paul Flynn. A hospital spokesperson said he had full access to PPE and free testing on site. Since the first month of the pandemic, more than 70 reporters at The Guardian and KHN have scrutinized numerous governmental and public data sources interviewed and the bereaved families spoken with them. The total number includes fatalities identified by labor unions, obituaries and news outlets, and in online postings by the bereaved, as well as by relatives of the deceased. The previous total announced by The Guardian and KHN was approximately 1,450 healthcare workers' deaths. The new number reflects the inclusion of data reported by nursing homes and health facilities to the federal and state governments. These deaths include the facility names but not worker names. Reporters cross-checked each record to ensure fatalities did not appear in the database twice. The tally has been widely cited by other media as well as by members of Congress. Representative Norma Torres referenced the data, citing the need for a pending bill that would provide compensation to the families of healthcare workers who died or sustained long-term disabilities from COVID-19. Senator Ron Wyden mentioned the tally in a Senate Finance Committee hearing about the medical supply chain. "The fact is," he said, "the shortages of PPE have put doctors and nurses in the U.S. in grave danger."
Thank you. food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and it is related in a hadith from the infallible Ahlul Bayt of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. O Jesus, let your tongue say the same in secret and in the open, and let your heart and your vision be in accord with that. Turn your heart and your tongue entirely away from the forbidden, and withhold your eyes from anything in which there is no good. How many a beholder there has been whose look planted in their hearts a lust and threw them into the pit of destruction.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And of course, we reach this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam speaks about the issue of being content, where he says, Tarahu qani'atan nafsu. You will see that his soul is in a state of piety. Now, when we say that a person who is pious, you will see that a pious person is one whose soul is in a state of contentment. When we say a person is content, in general we could say that it is in it's of two types. One, he is content because of what God has decided legislatively. One, and number two, he is content because of what God has decided existentially. These are two important things that we need to discuss. There's one, the existential decision of God, and there is the legislative decision of God. In both of these things, contentment means to be pleased with the decision of God. When we discussed previously about the issue of the LGBTQ movements, and let's say that the issue of feminism, all these fall into the issue of God's legislative decision that inshallah we will elaborate slightly today.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when we talk about God's legislative decision, we mean that there are certain things that God has permitted human beings to do, and there are certain types of things and certain limits that God has kept in those things that are permissible. Both things are legislative. So for example, we are allowed to eat, for example, beef. Yes? But there are limits to that. So God says, eat, but وَلَا تُسْرِفُوا, do not overeat. So beef is allowed, but we're not supposed to overeat. Contentment here would mean that you be content by not wasting. You see? You eat beef, but don't waste it. Don't be wasteful. Another form of legislative contentment here, a legislative decision, is that we are not allowed, let's say, to eat pork or let's say crocodile meat, right? So being content here would mean that you suffice with eating beef, let's say, and steak, but do not eat, let's say, crocodile meat. Here again is a form of contentment, that you are pleased with God's legislative decision. And that is where also the issue of the LGBTQ movement comes in. That when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said that you are allowed to satisfy your desires, especially the sexual desires, you're allowed, but you have to limit it to marriage between a man and a woman, and even not any woman, a woman who is not your blood relative, let's say, who for example is, and with all those qualities that are there in the Sharia. So I need to limit that, let's say, to one wife, or let's say if a person has necessity to four wives and not more, right? And of course if there is a need for temporary marriage, if there is a need for temporary marriage with its conditions required, then temporary marriage, right? But beyond that, or seeking more in that line, would be lack of contentment. Or even with a person's legal spouse, right? The same thing that comes about food, you overeat, you become sick, right? So with the spouse also the same thing happens, like over satisfaction also would be a problem. So, of course, these are things to do with the legislative will of God.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when it comes to marrying between a man and a woman, now comes to beyond that. Between a man and, let's say, a man and, for example, a woman and a woman, that nowadays these things have happened, unfortunately, in the societies. When it comes to this, this is also where the legislative decision of God comes in, where we need to limit our desires and our greed. Now, when it comes to greed, a human being naturally wants to satisfy those desires, and God has ascertained certain means. The moment a human being is not pleased with God's legislative decision and seeks beyond God's legislative decision, he's becoming uncontent. Let's say he's skipping the boundaries of contentment and entering the domain of greed. Now, he may claim that, no, I don't like it, and I'm more interested in this, and I'm more interested in that. Whatever they have their excuses are, the problem here is that the lack of belief in what God has decided for that person. As such, especially for believing people, this is a very critical issue to consider when it comes to these particular types of tendencies that exist in the world of today. The actual answer, therefore, would be to limit oneself from greed. And the problem that exists today is that the world is actually bargaining with people, and it is actually basing the whole system of the political, economic, and social systems on greed. And that is what causes disruption in the society. When you base family relationships on greed, when you base economic relationships on greed, that causes destruction. And that is what we are seeing happening in the world of today. So if a person was to be content with the legislative decision of God, then definitely that would be very good for him, would be a source of progress for mankind, and a source of, you can say, upheaval in terms of their good character and their good natures. And let us, you know, pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at this moment that He inculcates the issue of contentment in our hearts, so that we are always pleased with God's decision, with God's legislative decision regarding our lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
According to Daya al-Assadi, an Iraqi politician and former member of parliament,
people are talking not only about ISIS, but a new version that might arise now. For months now, the Iraqi government, along with Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, or the PMU, has been warning that Daesh is exploiting the coronavirus epidemic in the war-torn country and the rising conflict there to resurge. Daesh attacks have now been on the rise for several months. These fears were enhanced after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror commanders Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis on January 3, 2020. On January 20th, in fact shortly after the assassination, the United Nations sent a report to the UN Security Council warning it that Daesh had begun to reassert itself in both Iraq and Syria through increasingly bold attacks. Later in 2020, the Under-Secretary General of the United Nations Office of Counter-Terrorism, Vladimir Voronkov, told the Security Council that measures to minimize the spread of COVID-19, such as lockdowns and restrictions on movement, seem to have reduced the risk of terrorist attacks in many countries.
The COVID-19 crisis has highlighted the challenges we face in eliminating the threat of terrorism. ISIL and other terrorist groups seek to exploit the far-reaching disruption and negative socio-economic and political impacts of the pandemic.
It seems that this is nowhere more prevalent than in Western Asia, Syria and Iraq.
At the start of the year, we have seen contrasting regional disparities in the threat trajectory. In conflict zones, the threat has increased, as evidenced by ISIL's regrouping and increasing activity in Iraq and the Syrian Arab Republic, and among some of its regional affiliates.
Daesh emerged from the remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a local offshoot of Al-Qaeda founded by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in 2004. The group changed its name to ISIS or Daesh in 2013. Daesh launched an offensive on Iraq's Mosul and Tikrit in June 2014. On June 29th, Daesh leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi announced the formation of a so-called caliphate stretching from Aleppo in Syria to Diyala in Iraq. Then in 2014, Iraq's most senior Shia cleric issued a call to arms after Daesh seized Iraqi cities. The call by a representative of Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani in the holy city of Karbala. After the call, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis took up arms and joined what is now known as the PMU. These same forces believe that the US was behind Daesh all along. According to Muhammad Mahdi al-Bayati, a leader in Iraq's Badr organization, which is part of the country's popular mobilization forces, said that eyewitnesses living along the border with Syria have informed security officials that American forces are conducting extensive airborne transfers of Daesh terrorists from Syria to Iraq. PMU forces revealed fresh attempts by Washington and Saudi Arabia to facilitate the return of fugitive Daesh militants to Iraq. Back in May of this year, at least 10 members of the PMU, better known by their Arabic name Hashdul Sha'bi, were killed in a coordinated attack carried out by Daesh in Iraq's north-central province of Salahuddin. A senior commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit says the recent Daesh attacks on PMU positions are part of a U.S. plot to extend the American troops' presence in Iraq. In 2018, Yeni Shafak, a Turkish daily newspaper quoting sources, reported on that there had been many cases of U.S. forces directly delivering material and technical assistance to Daesh militants in the town of Al-Mansura, which is located in the northern Syrian province of Raqqa. In fact, the U.S. has long been accused of supporting terrorism in the region. WikiLeaks exposed an email from Jake Sullivan in 2012, who was Deputy Chief of Staff Deputy to ex-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton during former U.S. President Barack Obama's tenure, informing her that al-Qaeda is on America's side in Syria. Jake Sullivan has been recently nominated as National Security Advisor by U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. Even U.S. President Donald Trump, during his campaign for the presidency in 2016, admitted that the U.S. government is responsible for the rise of Daesh.
It was Hillary Clinton that she should get an award from them as the founder of ISIS. That's what it was. That's what it was. Her weakness. Her weak policies.
A few days later in 2016, Trump doubled down on his claims that the U.S. created the Daesh terrorist group.
In many respects, you know, they honor President Obama. ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS, okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
Earlier this year, after the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution's Guards Corps, IRGC, and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the PMU's second-in-command, the Iraqi parliament has voted to remove U.S. troops from Iraq. On May 1st, several Daesh units launched a coordinated advance against members of the Iraqi state-supported Popular Mobilization Unit, PMU, north of Baghdad. These complex and coordinated attacks are indications of an organization that is winning back real power. According to the United Nations in 2010, before Daesh began its big rise in 2013 and 2014, it had around 700 militants available. Today, Daesh has 2,000 to 3,000 militants in Iraq and Syria each, and that shows the danger they pose. U.S. Special Envoy for the so-called Global Coalition to Defeat IS, James Jeffrey, speculated that the militia had between 14,000 and 18,000 militants in Syria and Iraq. But the U.S., on the other hand, is fighting the same groups that rid Iraq of Daesh. Earlier this year, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had warned Iraqi President Barham Saleh that Washington was ready to shut its diplomatic mission in Baghdad and take action against anti-terror resistance groups. The decision to close the embassy in Baghdad is in President Trump's hands and is ready. If our forces withdraw and the embassy is closed in this way, we will liquidate all those who have been proven to have been involved in these attacks, Pompeo said in a letter delivered to the Iraqi president. Perhaps the U.S. is orchestrating another rise for Daesh as it plans in the region once again fail due to the vigilance of the people. After all, Daesh rose in Iraq shortly after the U.S. was forced to leave Iraq by 2011 because Washington couldn't reach an agreement with Baghdad over that issue. And now, as the U.S. is getting ready to leave once again from Iraq, and this time for good, Daesh seems to be resurging. Is there a connection? Only time can tell.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the Limelight.
All 10 U.S. defense secretaries still living, including two who worked for Donald Trump, have called for the president and his supporters to accept that he lost the election and warned against attempts to involve the military in his increasingly desperate efforts to overturn the election result. Among the signatories was James Mattis, who served as defense secretary in the Trump administration. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Julian Borgia. The piece is titled, Leave Military Out of It, Former Defense Secretaries Tell Trump. Stay with us for more of Julian Borgia's article. All 10 former U.S. defense secretaries still living, including two who worked for Donald Trump, have called for the president and his supporters to accept that he lost the election and warned against attempts to involve the military in his increasingly desperate efforts to overturn the election results. In an unprecedented joint letter published in the Washington Post, the defense secretaries addressed the worst fears of what could happen in 17 days of Trump administration's remaining before Joe Biden's inauguration. An attempt by Donald Trump to foment a crisis with the aim of triggering a military intervention in his last-ditch struggle to hold on to power. Among the signatories to the extraordinary letter was James Mattis, who served as defense secretary in the Trump administration. Efforts to involve the U.S. armed forces in resolving election disputes would take us into dangerous, unlawful, and unconstitutional territory, the letter said. Civilian and military officials who direct or carry out such measures would be accountable, including potentially facing criminal penalties, for the grave consequences of their actions on our republic. Among the signatories were James Mattis and Mark Esper, who both served as defense secretaries in the Trump administration. Mark Esper openly contradicted Donald Trump in June by insisting there were no grounds for invoking the Insurrection Act, which allows for deployment of U.S. troops on American streets in extreme circumstances. Dick Cheney, defense secretary under George H.W. Bush and vice president to his son George W. Bush, and Donald Rumsfeld, defense secretary in the younger Bush administration, also signed the letter. The other signatories were William Perry and William Cohen, defense secretaries in the Bill Clinton administration, Leon Panetta, Chuck Hagel, and Ashton Carter, who served under Barack Obama, and Robert Gates, who served under both the younger Bush and Barack Obama. Transitions, which all of us have experienced, are a crucial part of the successful transfer of power. They often occur at times of international uncertainty about U.S. national security policy and posture, the former defense secretaries wrote in the letter. There can be a moment when the nation is vulnerable to actions by adversaries seeking to take advantage of the situation. They called on the current defense secretary, Christopher Miller, and his officials to resume cooperation with the incoming Biden transition team, who had complained their briefings had been cut off and the Pentagon had ceased answering their inquiries. The Washington Post quoted Eric Edelman, a former U.S. ambassador and defense official, as saying the genesis of the remarkable letter was a conversation that he had with Dick Cheney about how the military might be used in the coming days. There are concerns over unrest this Wednesday, 6th of January, when a dozen Republican senators say they will challenge the normally routine congressional ratification of the Electoral College result. Donald Trump has urged his supporters to rally in Washington, tweeting,